people feel comfortable when they walk in the door, and that being a small town, it helps.
This is Jonesy's Cafe on Main Street in Paris. That's Paris, Missouri, population 1,200 in the northeast corner of the state. It's kind of a gathering spot. A reporter from KBIA Radio in Columbia talked to some of the regulars 3 years ago.
Come here about every morning. On a Friday morning, I eat with the, there's four of us eat together, and we just, 1 week I pay, the next week the other guy pays, and we share that.
Paris, Missouri is the town George Hodgman returned to after years, decades actually, living a slightly more fast-paced lifestyle in New York City. I'm Gina Kaufman, and George is with us now on Central Standard. George Hodgman, does that sound like the Paris, Missouri you know?
I didn't hear it very well, to be absolutely truthful, but I imagine it did.
Jonesy's Cafe, is that a place you know?
Oh, it's a place I've gone since I was 3 years old.
Tell us about
cheeseburgers.
It. Cheeseburgers. You've written this memoir, Bettyville, about your own life, of course, but your mother's life, too, and the life of small town Missouri. Why do you call it Bettyville?
Because Bettyville in the book is really Paris, Missouri during my mother's era and the era of my parents and their friends and the generation who went to World War II and came back and built little houses and started little businesses and really were very, very involved in the community and gave the place a kind of all-American identity.
The book opens with these words, Missouri is a state of stolen names. And then you list all these town names in Missouri, like Paris or Rome, Cairo, Carthage, New London. I did not even know that we had a Japan, Missouri. What do you make of this whole thing?
I like to imagine, I mean, this is sort of my own poetic notion, but we're in the center of the world, you know, when we have rivers, but we're far away from the ocean and we're far away from, you know, what were kind of the centers of civilization at a certain point. And I think I like to think that there's kind of a longing for other places that people felt. And
so we bring the world here.
And that they were more contained and kind of were reaching.
Why was this a notion that you wanted to open the book with?
Because one thing, my grandmother always wanted me to see the world. She always said that. And she only saw the Pacific Ocean. She saw it once. And I was kind of raised with travel longing. And my mother really has always wanted to travel. She always wanted to get up and go. And one of her regrets now that she is elderly is that she didn't travel more, and she always bring up, is it too late to take a trip? And so I wanted to sort of capture a certain kind of longing to go somewhere.
I want to get back to the story of small towns in Missouri because I think that matters a great deal to people around here. But let's get to your story first. At the time when you are kind of beginning the journey of this book in a way, you're living in New York, living the city life, and you come home to visit your mother only to find she's showing signs of dementia. Can you talk about that moment?
She'd lost her driver's license. And my mother was so independent and so mobile. And she was like the archetypal American driving across the plains. And when she lost her driver's license, it was like a little death for her. And she and our housekeeper, and I didn't know this, they were keeping this a secret, as they did the fact that she'd lost her driver's license, were practicing for her to retake the driver's test, which was a comic scene I can't imagine. but I came home, she'd lost her license, and I was just going to stay for a little while, but it, you know, I watched her and I watched her struggle, and I, and we also made each other laugh, and I hadn't had a home like that in 25 or 30 years.
What had brought you back for this visit?
What brought me back? Originally, it was her birthday. It was her 90th birthday.
And then, so you come back noticing that all this other stuff is going on and that you... Do I understand right? You thought you were just going to take care of her for a little while, and that's the period you're describing now where you're making each other laugh and all of that.
Well, I'd been on the lookout for signs that she couldn't live alone or that she had, was having trouble. I mean, she was 90. And I noticed, I mean, she'd lost her boyfriend. She had a boyfriend, and he died, and she was spending more and more time on the couch alone. She wasn't cooking, couldn't drive anymore. And she was forgetting. And she's asking the same questions again and again and again. And so I decided to stay until we could find, you know, whatever the next chapter was, we needed to find it. And I just got used to being there. And
you had been living in New York. What had drawn you there in the first place?
Everything. I was a kid who grew up dreaming of New York, and I love movies and theater and writing and books and everything that New York is the center of. And I always wanted big city life. And I was, you know, I spent my childhood trying to get my parents to take us to St. Louis or Kansas City.
When did you finally move to New York?
83.
Tell me about your social life there, what it was like when you got there, and the community that you had forged for yourself, the life you had forged for yourself in New York.
Well, New York was itself. You know, I was I started out with some, you know, dingy little jobs that I didn't really want to have, and I thought
what
I should immediately
dingy?
Become famous. And
what kind of dingy little jobs?
I worked for a publishing company that did books about computer systems analysis. I couldn't even use a computer. I was just a comic nightmare at that job. It was like Lucy. And then I went to Wall Street for a very brief time. I can't balance a checkbook. I had no business even walking into the neighborhood. And then I got a job at Simon & Schuster writing flap copy, and I loved it. And I loved reading the books, and I loved writing about it and working with the editors. And I gradually realized, hey, you should be an editor. This is what you should do. And I, you know, advanced and worked on books, went to Vanity Fair later on. And
there's a lot of intensity in your career in the passages about New York.
Well, New York is intense, and the thing that I loved about my career and have, you know, I met a lot of people who are very driven, ambitious, successful people. Some people might say that they're monsters. Some people might find them difficult, but I found them fascinating.
You write about your family and your hometown of Paris, Missouri, with a combination of kind of fondness and struggle. The struggle having mostly to do with you're not entirely feeling like you fit in or had room to be yourself. Can you talk about that?
Well, I knew I was a gay kid. I knew that I was gay from the time I opened my eyes, I think, and the first time I ever heard the word, I knew. And
that it had something to do with you?
Yeah, and that it was had a lot to do with me. And it was the 70s, and you know, it was before anybody was out. It was before there were people on television who were gay or even magazines. You know, it was a dark time. And I think that so much of who I am is based on growing up as a gay kid who was keeping a secret in a place that didn't want to know that secret.
Yeah, as a reader, I felt like, as an adult, as you immersed yourself in Paris, Missouri again, and you surrounded yourself with those memories again, I kind of felt like I was reading your process of realization about forces in that environment that taught you to be ashamed and how maybe that contributed to some of your struggles, not only coming out as gay, but also like with substance abuse, stuff like that.
I think that gay kids grow up with shame, that you internalize shame. You hear everything. You know, you never hear anything positive if you're a gay kid about being gay, or you didn't when I grew up. And you heard, you know, sissy and effeminate and this and that, even from people who were well-intentioned. And, you know, you kind of grew up, or I grew up, I didn't know what my role was. I knew I wasn't going to marry and have a family and settle down.
And that's what's around you.
Excuse me?
And that's what's around you in that town.
Pardon me?
That's the sort of model that's around you in that town.
Yeah. I mean, the only model I didn't fit. So I was very conscious of the fact that I was going to have to rig up something, you know, and I didn't know what it was. And so I have always, always relied on career and ambition to give my life some kind of structure. And work was family to me. And I think that one of the reasons that I stayed with my mother when I came home was that I had been in, you know, making my way in the work world for so long and under a lot of stress and from my own, the pressure that I put on myself to succeed. And I got back and it was like, oh, family,
yeah,
home.
Yeah. There's this whole rest of life.
And I was just very drawn in.
There were occasional characters in these childhood scenes who felt to me, as I read about them, like salvation. I actually did laugh out loud at a line from your grandma's sister. I'm not sure how to pronounce her name. I think Sade or...
Sadie.
Sadie. Do you know the line I'm talking about?
I think I'd like to hear you say it, if you wouldn't mind.
Okay, I'll try it. Although I believe she had a husky voice, and I'm not sure I can pull that off. So I'm not going to try a voice. Toots, we got to get you to Boca. I think you're kind of a fish out of water.
Yeah, she did. She was like a gravelly voice, smoky old broad with white hair. And she lived in Chicago. And her husband was an ice magnet. I loved the sound of that. I was like, you know, an ice magnet. And they lived in Kenilworth. They were rich. And she was very glamorous to me. And she had a house in Boca Raton, Florida. And they had a Florida room. She kept talking about her Florida room. And that totally lit up my imagination.
She sounds a lot like my grandma, to tell you the truth. Even though in your life now in Paris, Missouri, it doesn't sound to me as though you generally broadcast that you're gay, although you are doing that right now on the radio, I guess. Some people in your town seem to pick up on it. Like, you've got this insurance saleswoman randomly confiding in you that she thinks her stepson is gay and she's worried about him and wants to support him. What's that sort of experience like?
Well, I mean, if you're 50 years old, people have sort of figured out that maybe you're not too shy. I mean, to date or something, you can't be in the closet at 50. It's self-evident, even in Paris, Missouri.
Although with your mom, it sounds like, to some extent.
Well, my mother just didn't talk about it. You know, my mother wasn't raised to talk about these things.
So it's more of a don't ask, don't tell policy.
Yeah, and she didn't talk about her own personal things either. But in Paris, I got back there, and there were people who approached me because they didn't have anybody to talk to about this issue in their lives. And this one woman came up to me and told me that one of her friends had told her that she was a terrible mother because her daughter turned out to be a lesbian. And there we stood in the IGA, and I was trying to give her a hug, and then this woman who was selling me some insurance talked to me about her son's struggle and her husband's struggle to accept her son. And
I think she referred to him as being like that. That he's an artist, you know, like that.
Yeah. You're right.
It's sort of, it just seems to me that after so much of an adulthood in New York, was that a hard thing to readjust to? Just so much uneasiness around the subject?
Well, it turned out that I think that many times, if you're gay, if you're different, you internalize so much negativity, and you may think that people are more judgmental than they really are. And I think that people are judgmental in the abstract. They may say, oh, this is a sin, or this is written, you know, in the Bible that you shouldn't be gay, or, you know, they may have political leanings that, you know, are anti-gay. But one-on-one in a small town like that, people are pretty good to each other. And I haven't faced much tension. And since this book came out, I mean, I'm as out of the closet as you can be. And I've gotten a huge amount of sweet, warm support.
That's really wonderful. It would be easy to assume that the scenes in the book that would create this tension around this issue of sexuality and just ability to connect with this community would be the ones in Missouri. But it's actually the scenes, for me, when your parents visit you in New York that hurt the most to read, just because of your own struggle to connect with them there and to show them your life.
I think it was because by that time I had reached an age where I was expected, we were expected to talk about how my personal life was going, how things had resolved. And I felt uncomfortable because I felt like I didn't have enough to tell them. And what I did have to tell them, they didn't necessarily want to hear. And I moved to New York, you know, in the thick of the AIDS epidemic. And so there was so much that I couldn't tell them for fear of scaring them, hurting them. And so much of my first 5 years in New York were about AIDS in some way, my own fear that I might have it. And the worst part, the worry that I might have it and that they would lose me and have to deal with that on their own.
So you were kind of trying to protect them.
In those years, I was very much trying to protect them because I was in New York and they seemed suddenly very innocent to me.
Before you actually moved back to Missouri later on, and then when you moved back and found it not intolerable at the very least, but what would the you living in New York in sort of your greatest immersion there have thought about the idea of eventually moving back to Missouri?
In a very odd way, I always knew that I would wind up here. I mean, I have a friend from Rhode Island, and he always says, Rhode Island bred, Rhode Island dead. And that's the way I feel about Missouri. I knew that I would somehow come back here. This is earlier, and I didn't really see myself in Paris. I saw myself in maybe teaching in Columbia or in St. Louis or somewhere.
Did Missouri feel like home to you when you returned, or had you transformed in some way in the years of your absence into a New Yorker?
I had transformed into a New Yorker, but Missouri has never for a moment stopped feeling like home to me, particularly these little towns.
Central Standard is headed to a short break. We'll return to this conversation with George Hodgman, author of the memoir Bettyville, when we return. You can tell us about the small Missouri towns you know at 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. You're listening to Central Standard. Our guest this morning is the author George Hodgman. He lives in Paris, Missouri, which he affectionately calls Bettyville, after his mother, Betty. George will be reading from his memoir at Unity Temple on the Plaza this evening at 7 as part of the Rainy Day Books author series. That's this evening at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Welcome back, George Hodgman.
Thank you.
So a lot of your book is about caring for an aging parent in the home, and I want to acknowledge that even though we have another focus this morning. What are some of the things you've learned about caring for an elderly parent rather than getting help either through in-home nurses or by checking her in somewhere?
Well, I always say when dealing with an older woman, a trip to the hairdresser and 2 gin and tonics does better than any prescription medication.
I'll write that down.
So that is one thing. what I've learned is that I didn't think I could do this. I'm not trying to come up as, a saint or anything like that. I'm somebody who didn't think. I had no children, I couldn't grow a cactus. I had no pet. I had nothing. And I didn't think I could get my mother through this period. I just didn't think it was possible. And I learned that we coped with our crisis day by day, one day at a time. And I learned that, I may not be able to fill out her income tax. I may not be able to, cook very well. But what I can do is figure out one or two things every day that makes her happy, whether it's ice cream or watching Dirty Dancing or
Wednesday night prime rib special.
Yeah, the catfish special.
So much of the book is about your deep desire, even just momentarily, to break the rules that you and Betty have spent a lifetime establishing with each other. I think a lot of people can probably relate to that. Have you had moments of breakthrough there? I mean, no matter what it is, we all just have unofficial rules with people in our lives.
I think that that we all have to sort of live with the reality that capital B breakthroughs are something that happen in the movies. And one of the things that I wanted to be in this book was real and human. And our breakthroughs have usually been little b, little letters, whispers of a breakthrough. I'm still going to be who I am. My mother's going to be who she is. But we may not have found the space where I can talk to her about my boyfriends or my romantic life or something. We may not ever find that. But what we have is great warmth and, more than anything, humor. And I wrote this book because everybody said, you two are so funny together. And so I think that there's so much unspoken that we address through humor, and there's kind of a Harold and Maude aspect. And so and I think that there are moments certainly where we have found a mutual acceptance.
I think I remember you saying that the book started when your friends encouraged you based on your Facebook posts about life at home with your mother. And I looked at your Facebook page. Your most recent post is from the hospital, and you quote Betty as saying, "I'm not going to die here. I'm going to die somewhere with better food."
She said that just the other day.
Is that the kind of humor that you're talking about?
Yeah. My mother is I think there really is a Missouri humor. I think there's an old farmer kind of Mark Twain, like really dry, sort of a comment humor. My mother never thinks of herself as making a joke. She doesn't make a joke, but she makes very wry comments.
Can we talk about small towns in Missouri? Tell me about the small towns in Missouri that you knew growing up, because there wasn't just Paris. There was also Madison.
Madison was 528 people when I grew up there, and it really was a village. It was a village. And
what do you mean by that?
I don't really know what kind of distinction I make between village and town, but maybe because the country overflowed in. And the town kind of overlapped so much, and the roads. I grew up with, on dirt roads and tar roads, and also. But what I most remember about Madison and is the characters, and it's where I learned to love to listen to people talk, and it was, rural Missouri is a very rich culture. And I think it did take me going to New York to realize that Missouri was a place, an interesting, unique place.
That had its own, maybe even music of language, it sounds like.
Oh, definitely a music of language.
Why did your family move from Madison to Paris, Missouri?
My father worked in my mother's family's lumberyard, and we had four lumberyards. They were all in these small towns that were too close. The one where my father worked had to close, and so we moved to Paris so he could work at a different branch.
But it sounded in the book like your mother especially had been very attached to Madison, and that the move was kind of like this early, like, maybe harbinger of the small town Missouri thing of, like, towns just not being able to sustain themselves sometimes.
Well, I think my father was the one who was more attached to Madison because when he ran his own lumberyard, he had more autonomy. When we moved to the town where my uncle was the manager, my father had less autonomy. But the closing of that lumberyard in Madison, Missouri, very much was a harbinger of things to come. It was one of the big cornerstones of the town that was lost, you know, quickly. And then the rest of the town started gradually disappearing.
Do you think that your family's migration to this other town out of a smaller town that you would even characterize as a village, is it representative of a larger trend?
The only trend that I can really recognize is the trend now that these towns, Columbia seems to have really drained off these towns because that's where the work is. And the small farms have disappeared and they're now just, you know, really big farms run by a few families. People have to find jobs and Columbia is a place.
Columbia is a place. That is such a telling phrase, don't you think?
Well, I like Columbia a lot. But I do regret so much. I mean, I mourn the loss of these places. And when I go back to Madison, I can go down the streets and I can tell you in every single house where, you know, who lived there when I was a little kid. And I can give you a lot of memories of all those people. And I just spoke at the Madison Christian Church in the basement about a week ago. And I gave them these memories. I just sort of reeled out this fabric of my memory from childhood. And it was extremely moving to me. I mean, that I haven't ever had people respond to anything like that. Because
how did they respond?
Well, I watched their eyes. It was like little kids on Christmas morning or some people just kind of waking up and going back and returning. And I also think, and I don't mean to flatter myself in any particular way, but I think that here I was this person who had been in New York, but what I remembered with this incredible vividness was them. And so I think they were touched. And I think that I was able to give them a picture of a place that they loved as special rather than just a place that was in decline.
If you have a deep connection to a small Missouri town, call us up at 816-235-2888. What's happening in the town you know? Are there opportunities for people who want to keep living there? 816-235-2888. George Hodgman, remind me when you moved to New York again?
1983.
How much had Paris, Missouri changed between the time you left and the time you returned?
It was much more vital when I left. My family's businesses were beginning to close, but there was still activity on Main Street, or more activity.
What did that activity look like?
I associate Paris, Missouri with people going to the shoe store. There was a shoe store. Everybody came and went to the shoe store, and there was this amazing dime store called Delaney Variety, and you would go there to get your school supplies. It smelled. There was something I'll never forget that smell. And they had, you know, a candy case, a glass candy case, and there, you know, for some reason these towns, there are always like 50 beauty parlors. Their churches and beauty parlors are basically small town Missouri, but. You know, and old farmers coming out of the barber shop and spitting, you know. Nobody can spit like an old farmer. And so I have a lot of very colorful pictures floating through my head of that.
There's a scene in the book. You take your mother to a wedding, and all the people who have gathered there, you call them the elders of Paris, Missouri, and you call them the people who used to run things around here. I want you to read that passage. Do you mind?
All around that night at the wedding were people I had grown up with, friends of my parents, our lawyer and accountant, a judge or two, the bridge club ladies, people we had always known from church, those who used to run things around here. All my childhood was gathered around me. This was not just a collection of the elders of Paris, Missouri. It was more to me. It was Bettyville, my mother's home, her place, with most of its surviving souls, those who had known her as a girl and who had been kind to me and watched me grow. They were older suddenly, much older, my people, men in white shoes fit for a bandbox, striped suits from other decades, women in outfits that looked to have been stored away and worn only occasionally. And all I wanted, suddenly, was to stay with them forever. I love my town. I love my home. I went from table to table to hug all of them as the younger guests spilled out of the banquet room into the summer night to dance.
That's so beautiful. You know, you talk about the younger guests. What is your sense of what they're going to do? Are they going to graduate from high school or go to college and go elsewhere? Or do you are there people who want to reinvest or reinvent Paris, Missouri?
I think there are younger people who have a huge investment and identity still connected to the town. I think that one of my huge worries is that the education, the high school education, is not what it was. And, for example, kids from Paris can't take a foreign language in school. There's no foreign language teacher. So they can't go to MU. They can't go to state universities. They have to go to junior college or community college.
Oh, they're just disqualified before they even try?
And that just, I felt like I wanted to scream. I mean, and I get in trouble at dinner parties because I'm, you know, shut up about your guns. Look at your schools. Please, look at your schools. And so I worry about those kids. And I think that they want to be there. But, you know, I also think they should get out. They should get out. But
But college would be one of those main pathways.
Yeah. And college is a way. I mean, you can go to college and you can come back. And I think that I think we have to look really carefully at what we're losing and why.
Speaking of getting in trouble in your town, there's another passage that I'd like you to read. Do you mind doing that? It's there on page 218.
Well, this is I'm taking my mother to dinner to cheer her up. And there's a place that we pass always. It's an old Presbyterian church in Perry. And that church is actually closed, and it always makes my mother sad. My mother fears the day that our own church will be vacant. The notion of her town without her church, her life without her church, her world without its center is enough to make her turn her head away from the window. Like Betty, I am scared about the days to come, and am reluctant to desert the place where people who know of my mother's bad days come up to embrace me. They say they will do anything to help. A guy I went to school with wants to know how I am doing and asks if I want to accompany him and his family to Branson to see Kenny Chesney. I thank him, but I say I cannot forgive Kenny for what he did to Renee Zellweger. You are always different, my friend tells me, touching my arm and smiling a little before getting into his vehicle. Gradually, I have come to feel that I fit here, at least a little. I suddenly know people again and am Dear Abby for those who are real different. A week or so, a woman from my high school class stopped me to say she is stuck in a trailer with a son who thinks he has a black woman living inside him. Tell him to let her out, I said.
You use that phrase, real different. Is that a phrase you hear a lot?
It is. It's usually kind of – there's a negative about it. My aunt always said it, and my mother – if I give my mother, say, Mexican food, she'll say, oh, that's real different.
Let's talk to some callers. We've got Nicole from Prairie Village. Hi, Nicole.
Hi.
What can you share?
Well, I just wanted to call and say I'm from Mexico, Missouri, and I have really enjoyed listening to your speaker this morning. I have very affectionate memories of growing up in my small town. My parents were both teachers there for 30 and 33 years. And I always joke about being raised by the village.
Oh.
So, anyway.
It sounds like you're getting choked up. What do you think, I mean, is being able to go back to Mexico, Missouri important to you in your life today, even as you live in Prairie Village?
Oh, most certainly. It's a magical place. Thank you.
Thanks, Nicole.
My aunt and uncle lived in Mexico, and I spent a lot of time there.
I think we heard Nicole getting kind of choked up there, and I don't mean to, like, draw extra attention to that, except that the prospect of your hometown just disappearing, no matter what that town is, anyone from anywhere imagining that, it's sad. I mean, to lose a concrete connection to the people and memories that form your identity going all the way back.
Well, life is giving up. Life is all – growing up is giving up so much that you were familiar with. We all have to endure change. And yet there is some change that I think we could possibly do a better job of preventing.
Let's talk to Annette in North Kansas City. Hi, Annette.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. How about you?
Very well, thank you. I was calling because I'm from Tightwad, and
That is the name of a town. The T-shirts are hilarious.
Yeah. And one of the things that I have found as I've gotten older, and I think that I'm probably pretty close in age to your guest, is that it's drawn me back in. My husband and I have built a cabin down by Truman Lake, and we spend more time there as I've gotten older, and I really appreciate the roots that that we have down there now.
Thanks so much, Annette.
Thanks. Great topic.
Thank you. George, can you talk about your recurring nightmare of running in a field outside Madison, Missouri?
It's actually not exactly a nightmare. It's,
oh, okay.
It's kind of complex.
I don't mean to project.
But when I was a little kid, we had a soybean field out behind our house. And my friend and I would just run up and down the rows all the time. And all day long, we would kind of race. And we would run at night. And it was really scary to me to run at night, because we were barefoot, and I would think that I was going to step on a snake or something, or there would be something hidden in the field rows. And I still do. I have a dream, and it's usually about fear, and I think that dream is connected in some way to a feeling of loss of the things of my childhood.
George Hodgman, author of Bettyville, thank you so much for joining us this morning. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you.
George Hodgman reads from his memoir, Bettyville, tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Go to Rainy Day Books website for more information. And keep calling 816-235-2888 with those stories about the Missouri towns you're connected to. Because when we return, we'll hear about a small town in Missouri with one foot in this life and one in the next. Climax Springs prepares to vote itself out of existence. More on that in a minute. Welcome back. This is Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're still taking calls about the small Missouri towns you're connected to. Call 816-235-2888 to tell us about the fate of the Missouri town you know. That's 816-235-2888. We've got just a little time left for those calls. With me now is Dugan Arnett. He wrote a recent article in the Kansas City Star about the town of Climax Springs. Good morning, Dugan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What's happening in Climax Springs?
So what's happening is a woman there kind of spearheaded an effort, I guess, to dissolve the town. And this is a very, very small town, not much more than 100 people. And essentially the thinking behind dissolving it is that the county would then come in and kind of support it a little bit better. I think roads, road assistance, is a real big thing. And so basically this is going to go on the ballot down there in August, I believe. And most of the town seems like they're behind it. At the same time, there's some that are kind of, I guess, you know, wistful or nostalgic a little bit about the idea of, you know, not having, you know, a town anymore, I guess.
What does that nostalgia, I mean, if people see that there's this practical benefit in dissolving the town and that they can keep living there just as residents of the county who are rural residents, what is it that they feel they might lose without being able to say we are part of a town that's called Climax Springs, we have, you know, a government and all of that?
Sure, sure. Well, it's an interesting thing because based on all the conversations I had, there's not going to be a big difference day to day if this town ends up dissolving. There's going to be some practical benefits, like you mentioned, where the county's probably going to assist a little bit in places that they weren't before. But I think there's still a reluctance there, and I think that kind of stems from this idea that, you know, although things will be the same day to day, there's this loss of an identity a little bit. And, you know, this many people in this town go back generations and generations. And so, you know, while they'll continue to kind of refer to themselves as Climax Springs and that sort of thing, there is this idea that, you know, not having that sign out on the, you know, on the highway that says, you know, Climax Springs population, you know, 100 and whatever. I think there's kind of a little bit of a sadness behind that.
There's someone who's been trying to do this. I mean, it sounds like repeatedly. This is just the first time that there have been enough signatures to get it on the ballot. Is that right?
That's right. So there's a woman named Kathy Henderson who's spearheaded this. You know, this particular, motion about 8 times, I think. And this time she it sounds like went door to door and basically got the vast majority of the town's 55 registered voters to sign this petition. And so that basically was then passed on to the clerks, the county clerk's office, and you know, assuming everything is good, that'll go on the ballot and town will vote on it.
And when does that happen again?
That's in August, I believe, although there's a chance that if some snag happens that it could be the next election following that, so later in the year. But I believe it'll be August.
I'm going to come back to you, Dugan, but let's talk to Gail in Overland Park. Hi, Gail.
Hi, Gina. Thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me all right?
Absolutely.
Great. I grew up in a tiny town in Missouri called Chilhowee, Missouri. It's between Clinton and Warrensburg. And, you know, I just wanted to say the gentleman that you had on is, he's just so absolutely right. No matter where you go after you leave a small town, you know, when you're out of high school, you want to get away and go to the big city and live a different life. But that small town is always in your soul.
How?
And,
yeah, go on.
You
I'm
know,
sorry.
I feel the same way from the woman from Tightwad. I just get clamped about thinking about that small town and the people in it.
What do you have an idea of, you know, like what a future of a small town like this could look like that's viable, or is that just anyone's best guess?
You know, Gina, the people are different now. Most of those people that I grew up with through the church and my teachers, they're all dead and gone, and about half of the people in my class, 13, stayed in town and farmed and lived around there, and half left and went to college and went on to other things. And there are still some people around. We were baby boomers. I graduated in 71, and I haven't been back in years. I go to high school reunions. My last one was the 40th. And you know, 12 out of 13 people showed up, and we just all felt so comfortable and akin with one another, even though we were all lives apart.
Yeah,
and
just having that place to go
really
back
much,
to.
Yeah, I don't really think there's much hope for small town America these days, unfortunately, unless the millennials, you know, decide to go back to the country.
Thanks for that call, Gail. The idea of millennials doing something is an interesting one that maybe we'll have a chance to pick up on. But I want to talk to Rob, who's, I think, driving through Liberty, Rob?
It's Bob, actually. And yeah, I'm driving through Liberty right now. Sure.
They rhyme. Our apologies. What can you tell us about a Missouri small town?
I grew up in West Plains, Missouri. I'm a Zizzer. And the richness that growing up in that town provided me, and I've been gone from there for 50 years, but I constantly am able to tap that richness in my career, in my family life, and in everything that I do. And I'm looking back now. I've spent some time in rural Missouri a couple of years ago helping in a political campaign out in the middle of North Missouri. But I'm looking at what I heard described by George. As a matter of fact, I spent some time in Paris, Missouri during that campaign. And I want to encourage people that we have ways and means now to go back to these small communities and make some changes. Do some research on what's happening in Hamilton, Missouri, when a lady came in and started doing quilting videos on YouTube, and now employs over 120 people and is completely reinventing the town.
Is that through a quilting business?
A way to make a living now out there.
So you're saying the quilting business employs all these people?
In Hamilton, Missouri, yes, ma'am. You Google quilts in Hamilton, Missouri, and you'll find a booming business, for example. And those kinds of things can happen in other towns. I'd like to see them. West Plains is still pretty vital. Because there are some people stayed there. Some of us left, but some very vital people stayed there. But I'm saying that there are now ways to create business and opportunities for young people so that they don't go to college in Columbia or somewhere and never come back.
Thank you so much,
and that's
Rob.
That's what's happening. That's what's been happening.
I want to get back to our guest, because is there anyone in this town, Climax Springs, who has ideas for reinventing the town, or who's going to be a holdout from the idea of letting the town dissolve?
Well, there was one guy that we talked to that was pretty interesting. Although he supports the idea of dissolving and bringing in, the county assistants, he also thinks that could be kind of the first step in kind of reinvigorating things, I guess, so to speak. He spoke very passionately, like a lot of the callers about what the town means to him, how many generations his family goes back. I think he kind of views this as kind of a necessary step to kind of get things back on track a little bit. He's got some plans. I think he has a relative that plans to open up a store on the little kind of old town square, which is pretty much vacant right now. And so he's got,
Does he feel that freeing the town up from financially taking care of things like roads that it can't seem to afford, that maybe that creates the opportunity to refocus on some of these things? Like,
I think so. Yeah.
Business?
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to put it. And it is, this town is very small. Many of the roads are gravel and dirt. And I think, I think that's kind of a small, I think he looks at that as a small step. And once that's done, then, like you said, they can kind of turn their attention to what else do we need to do to kind of get this place back to where it was in its heyday.
A caller mentioned millennials. Did you hear any millennial voices there in Climax Springs?
We talked to the mayor, and granted, this is a village, and so there's not an official mayor. They're kind of trustees, but they kind of unofficially appoint someone mayor. But she would probably fit into that group. I mean, she was in her 30s, I think she has some. She has no plans to leave. So I think it's a situation where if enough people stay, who knows.
That's all the time we have for today's show. Dugan Arnett of the Kansas City Star and Inc. magazine, thanks for sharing your reporting today.
Thanks a lot.
Today's discussions about the fate of small towns in Missouri will be archived at kcur.org/centralstandard. You can listen back later today. Go ahead and sign up for the podcast of our show while you're at it. That way you'll catch every episode. The place to do it is kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, it's all about the Kansas City Star and what the daily paper of record means to people. There's still time to answer this week's Tell KCUR question about how you get your news. You can do that on our Facebook page or on Twitter using the Tell KCUR hashtag. Central Standard's produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date.